Coming up next on Tech News Weekly, it's me, Jason Howell, sitting over here, Micah Sargent sitting over there, and virtual people sitting in the TV behind us. We've got Kyle Wayne, CEO of iFixit, joining us to talk about how right-to-repair bills are actually progressing a lot right now throughout the U.S. Dan Morin from Six Colors gives an extensive preview of Apple's WWDC conference. That happens next week, by the way. Reddit's API apocalypse having real-world consequences for third-party developers. And Meta announced just this morning the new Meta Quest 3. All that and more coming up next.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 288, recorded Thursday, June 1st, 2023. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Dell. Client Solutions Devices, orchestrated by the experts at CDW, which deliver a more personalized user experience with adaptive AI-based software that boosts collaboration wherever your team works. Learn more at cdw.com/dellclient.
And by Bitwarden, get the password manager that offers a robust and cost-effective solution that drastically increases your chances of staying safe online. Get started with a free trial of a Teams or Enterprise plan, or get started for free across all devices as an individual user at bitwarden.com/twit. Hello and welcome to Tech News Weekly, the show where every week we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news. I am one of your hosts, Micah Sargent.
And all the way over here on the other side of the table, I am the other host.
There he is.
You can squint, you'll see me, Jason Howell. It's good to see you, Micah.
Good to see you.
Good to have back Kyle Weens from iFixit, because we've got a lot to talk about in this first interview with Right to Repair. Anytime there's progress made in the Right to Repair front, I don't know, it's kind of like one of those topics that I clue into, and I see it and I'm like, okay, great, because it's been such a long time coming. And iFixit, of course, has been fighting the fight. Kyle, you've been super involved with that. So Kyle, CEO of iFixit, welcome to the show. It's great to have you back.
Thanks for having me on. This is a good moment to have this conversation.
Absolutely. And actually, I should admit fully that one of our engineers here, Burke, had put into our company Slack the article from January about New York's Right to Repair bill. And when I first saw that, I was like, okay, you know, it was like I was reminded of it. And I was like, oh, well, we need to talk about this more. And then, kind of in the scope of like reaching out to you guys to bring Sam on, Goldhart, who wrote that article initially, then, you know, realized that there was other big news actually happening right now, not just back in January, but, you know, Minnesota, California. So we'll talk about all that in the next 10 to 12 minutes. But let's start with New York. Talk a little bit about the legislation in that state, because that seems to be kind of like the kicking off point for what we're seeing in other states right now, setting kind of those wheels in motion. Tell us a little bit about that.
Right. So New York is the first broad consumer electronics right to repair law that's passed. The governor signed it into law at the end of last year. It goes into effect at the beginning of next year, and it covers pretty much all the consumer devices in your life. With one catch, anything that you buy or that is made after July 1st of this year, it's not retroactive. But what it says is that manufacturers have to make available the same parts, tools, and information to you that they do to their authorized repair network. So if Apple has a fancy tool they're using at the Genius Bar, they need to make that available to the rest of us.
That is fantastic. I love how Sam put it in her write-up in January, just about anything with a price tag containing a chip, which actually makes it sound like so broad and everything. But like you said, there is a, you know, that significant hole. Is the hole that it doesn't apply retroactively, or are there other elements of this New York bill that were lacking in your opinion?
Yeah, the governor added two key loopholes. One was the July 1st limitation that it didn't go retroactive, which is frustrating because, of course, we want the right to repair the stuff we already own, not the stuff we're going to buy next, but it helps. And then the price tag is actually key, because by saying that it had to have a price tag, it cut out all of the enterprise products that you might buy, that the school might buy if they have to negotiate a Cisco contract or that kind of thing. So those were two major exclusions of the New York bill that we focused immediately after that to work on fixing.
Yeah, indeed. Now we've got, you know, kind of the more current news that's happening. First of all, just last week, Minnesota passed its own right to repair law. That actually goes even further than what the New York bill did. So tell us a little bit about what made you happy when you saw what's going on in Minnesota.
Yeah, so I mean, we were intimately involved. iFix has been leading the way with all this. I was intimately involved in negotiations with the governor in New York, and then working behind the scenes in Minnesota to get this bill done. And the Minnesota law is much more expansive than the New York law. It includes all products, not just products with that are sold at retail, and it also goes retroactive back to 2012.
No.
Or sorry, 2020. No, not 2012. It goes back 3 years. 2021. It goes back to the iPhone 12.
Okay.
It's the iPhone 12, which was introduced tail end of, I think, December 2020. That's when they went on sale, November. And so January 1, 2020 is the
kind of the cutoff. Okay. Yeah. And so that basically means that if I live in Minnesota and I've bought one of those older devices, regardless of the fact that this is a bill that's happening now, not then, it's still covered. Like, what is the responsibility then that lands on the side of, say, Apple, if I have one of those older devices? What exactly do they need to provide?
Yeah, so the manufacturer needs to make available, again, it's the same parts, tools, and information that they make available to their network. So what Apple has done with their independent repair program and now starting to sell parts to consumers, that's exactly what they need to provide. But Apple's only doing that for some of their products, and they're not doing it for everything. So, for example, you can't get a battery from an iPad from Apple right now. They're going to have to start doing that. Samsung has partnered with us. We're selling parts and tools for some Samsung products, but not enough. We're going to have to expand that program in order to help Samsung comply with the upcoming law.
Okay. Now, there is a part of this Minnesota bill that you have have been vocal about, because some of the articles I read were like, you know, iFixit CEO Kyle Weens. So you've been busy talking about some of this stuff. I mean, which makes sense. You guys are really, really active when it comes to putting kind of your weight of the company behind this progress. But what is it about the Minnesota bill that you did not like to see? Like, how is that impactful in the state?
So the one carve out is in the Minnesota bill is that there was an exemption around cybersecurity products, so products that are really only designed for use in cybersecurity applications. That was a loophole that was added at the last minute. I don't think it's too bad of a loophole, but it's definitely something to watch out for. It also doesn't apply to ag products, but Colorado passed a tractor right. repair law, which should help with that. But broadly speaking, you know, we're happy with it. There's one other exclusion that made it into the Minnesota bill that is annoying. We've been trying to make it so that diagnostic software tools don't require internet access, because that's a way that Apple has used to pair parts together. So if you buy a part through Apple's consumer parts program, you have to enter your serial number before you buy the part, and when you install the part, like matches to see if that's the serial number part that you bought. That's ridiculous. Because that blocks, let's say you have two phones that are not working and you want to take some pieces out of one and you put it in the other and use it. You can't do that with the way that Apple's designed their tool right now. So if we had diagnostic software that didn't require internet access or authentication, then it would allow you to do what you've always historically been able to do with your products, which is, hey, I have two things that don't work. Let me combine them, make some parts that work, and I'm off to the races.
Yeah, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me at all to have that in there. You've also expressed... I'd say displeasure on the fact that companies are actually let off the hook if a device is no longer made. That seems like a pretty glaring omission, because I think, you know, I have had many experiences where I've had a device that maybe isn't a current device, but that's kind of the point, is that I want to get as much life out of that. Is that the case here in Minnesota, that you can't do that?
Yeah, we have to find a way to expand the lifespans of all of our products.
For sure.
And so this is the challenge. With manufacturers, though, on the other side, they have to figure out how they're going to plan the supply chain of parts so they don't make way too many and have to eat that cost. But it would make sense to me that if you're end-of-lifing a product, do a final run of spare parts so you have them available. And that's where we're looking. We really need to have some kind of year threshold where there's a requirement of how long companies need to support their products for. And that leads us to California, because that's exactly what the proposed California law would do.
All right. So let's I love it. You set it up and I'm going to knock it out of the park. So California law, and this was actually just two nights ago, California advanced its right to repair bill in the Senate, 38-0 bipartisan vote. So seems like everybody's behind this. But yet there have been similar bills in the state for the past 5 years that have actually died in the California Senate. So I'm really curious to know, like, why is this one so supported when it's been such a long road to get to this point?
It's taken us a lot of time to build up the inertia and the momentum. Remember, we have trillions of dollars of market cap registered on the other side opposing this issue. And so it's really taken a huge coalescing. We have support from the Biden administration. The Federal Trade Commission issued a landmark report saying that they found no evidence supporting manufacturer repair restrictions. And that kind of evidence is starting to make its way to lawmakers, and they're seeing that history is on the side of making the change here.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what are we seeing out of this California law? What, I mean, we do, you know, Mike and I both and everybody here in the studio pretty much. Well, yeah, entirely. We all live in California. I don't think anyone's commuting to hear from
California. I do too. So this strikes home. It strikes home to me. No, I would note also this is important to Apple and Google and a few other tech manufacturers because they are here as well. And all the executives are here. So yeah, California is being very closely watched by the entire industry. California typically is the state that moves first on this kind of thing, but because the tech manufacturers are here and have such a strong lobbying presence, they've been able to delay it, and that's why you saw progress in Colorado and Minnesota and New York first. Now it's finally coming home.
So are you happy with, seeing as how you are a California citizen and this law has passed here, are there...
It hasn't passed completely.
It has not passed completely, but
yeah, it has to go through, right? It's got to go through the Senate and then the House.
Right.
And then if there's changes, they reconcile it and then the governor signs it.
We're not quite there yet. Chances are... If it goes through, there's probably going to be some permutations. And as is usually the case, they start to kind of negotiate these things. But based on where it's at right now, are you excited about what you're seeing? Is there anything in there that you're like, oh, God, yeah, I mean, this is progress, but it's not quite there?
Yeah, well, the exciting thing in the California law is it's based on an existing law. California actually has the best warranty law in the country. The Beverly Song Warranty Act says that manufacturers have to provide a repair option of some kind for 7 years if it's an electronic product that costs more than $100. That's unique in the world. Nowhere else does it require products to be maintained for 7 years. So if you have a Mac laptop, say, that was made in 2017 or something, Apple will repair it in California. They won't repair it in Oregon. So that has been a key difference. And that this new law also uses that 7-year time frame that manufacturers have to make parts, tools, and information available for that full 7 years, which is huge.
Interesting. All right, cool. Well, then I'll cross my fingers. Hope this continues to go along.
Or even better than crossing your fingers, call your legislator.
Call your legislator in the House
and tell them to support the bill.
That's the problem, right? It's like, oh yeah, we'll just sit back on the sidelines and hope.
Please don't. It won't happen if we all don't pitch in and help. This is one of those things. There's so much money on the other side.
There's so much interest.
And this really is one of those points in history where if we don't take this moment and pass this now, while we have this momentum, that we're not going to get another chance. There will be too much money. There'll be too much opposition. We're going through a pivot in the world of all the things that we have where electronics are moving into all of them. And the moment electronics move into a product, it goes from something you could fix to something you can't.
Right.
It gives manufacturers access to control products. So unless we weigh in now, we're going to lose access to owning all of our products forever.
Ugh. And there is nothing worse. Like, I've had this experience so many times where I have something that would be it's still in practically perfect condition, except for this one thing that renders it completely useless. There is no way to get it back. And if it weren't for that one thing, it's just wasteful and it's unnecessary. So I'll go ahead and make a commitment to you, Kyle, that I will get in touch with my legislature.
Fantastic. I made a handy tool for you. So if you go to california.repair.org, you can punch in your phone number and your zip code, and we will call you and then call your representative and connect you. You don't have to have another phone number.
That's amazing. California.repair.org. I love it. Thank you for that. That's fantastic. Kyle Waynes, you're doing excellent work. I love what you all do at iFixit, of course, but I love that you're also really pounding the pavement, as it were, when it comes to right to repair, and we're seeing progress. And so I want to thank you for all of that effort, and thank you for taking some time with us today. I know your schedule is busy, so we appreciate you.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. iFixit.com. Folks, you go there not only just for the tools and the services, the ability to fix your devices and stuff, but also for the education, because there is a lot posted there by their staff about things like exactly this. So thank you again, Kyle. All right. We have coming up next an interview with Dan Warren about WWDC. Which is right around the corner, and we're getting pretty excited about what we're going to see. So we're going to talk with Dan here in a moment. But first, let's take a moment and thank the sponsor of this episode. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Dell client solutions devices orchestrated by the experts at CDW. So the people at CDW, they get your unique workforce, has unique needs for their devices, especially as we all continue with hybrid work and all the ways that that permeates the industry right now. It's a challenge for IT to supply devices that can meet everyone's needs everywhere they work so that they can stay connected throughout the day. But luckily, CDW can help custom configure Dell client solutions devices for a more personalized user experience. So what that actually means is that your workforce gets adaptability for performance with AI-based software that learns how your team works and then optimizes workflows. And you can check this out as well. Dell client solutions devices have intelligent noise detection and cancellation, along with high quality video that adjusts with your lighting, which is pretty cool. This fleet of devices is really great because wherever your team actually works, its built-in security responds to malicious attacks, providing a secure way to boost collaboration and productivity from anywhere. So when it comes to seamless experiences, Dell Systems makes adaptive performance possible. CDW makes it powerful. You can learn more at cdw.com/Dell Client. That's cdw.com/Dell Client. We thank them for their support of Tech News Weekly. All right, let's take a trip to WWDC.
Woo! Yes. So Apple's WWDC, the Worldwide Developers Conference, will kick off on Monday. Pleased to say I will be there in person covering the event. As well as the person we have joining us on the show, I'll mention in a moment. But Apple's Worldwide Developers Conference is the time of year when Apple brings in developers from around the world. It's sort of like it's written in the title, Worldwide Developers Conference, to show off loads of new things, but mostly for the app developers who are making software for the various platforms Apple puts out. Joining us today from Six Colors to talk about this is my Clockwise co-host, Dan Morin. Welcome back to the show, Dan.
Hey, Micah, good to be here.
Good to have you. So let us kick things off. I think the best way to start is to talk about what we can always expect from WWDC. This is always, or at least up to this point, has always been the time when Apple announces the next version of its software and where we get to see some of the new features coming to that software. And then, of course, it is the opportunity for developers to see these new features and think about how to use them in their apps. So speaking specifically of software before we talk anything about hardware, let's kick things off with iOS, iPadOS. What are the rumors of what we can expect in iPhone and iPad land?
Well, for reasons that we'll discuss a little bit later, the rumors this year surrounding a lot of Apple's platform updates is that this might be a quieter year, which is to say there will still be new features, there will still be enhancements to existing features, but it might be a little less than we might see in the ordinary year because of other stuff going on. So with that in mind, there have been a bunch of things that have been rumored so far. Among them, most prominently on iOS, the addition of a new journaling app. This seems to be something that people are talking about a lot, which is the idea of an app which lets you sort of write down things that are going on in your life every day, maybe pull in information that it can access from other places on your phone. Like, oh, you know, you hung out with Micah at Apple Park on Monday. And we noted that. So when you go back and look at that day in the past, oh, yeah, June 5th, that's where I was. So that's one thing that has been sort of rumored to be a major part of iOS, at least possibly iPadOS as well. More recently, we've also seen a rumor of a new smart display feature on iOS 17 that would work on the lock screen. So In the same way that you can kind of put your Apple Watch down for the night and it goes into its little nightstand mode where it works like a little alarm clock, this would be something that's sort of taking that to the next level, probably using the always on screen in the more recent iPhones and being able to display little tiles of information when it's sort of in landscape mode sitting there overnight. We don't really know a lot of details about that, but that's something that's floated up in the last few weeks. And then on the iPad side, there's less there, but a few things that might show up. The health app might make a debut on the iPad. It's only been on the iPhone to date, but for those people who like viewing their health information on the iPad, this might be the year. And then there have been some rumors that widgets on the lock screen, which is something that came to iOS last year, may expand to the iPad as well this year. So look for smaller features like that to probably be the headlines for the iPad and iOS side of it.
Man, I really like the customized lock screen on iOS. So I'd love to see something like that on the iPad for sure. Yeah. Moving along, given that this is already going to be an event focused on something that we'll talk about momentarily.
We promise to bring you something.
The elephant in the room.
Yes, I don't want to distract, but it's sitting back there. You keep seeing the snout come into the screen and sort of tickle my ear. And I'm like, come on, hold on. We'll talk about it in a minute. Hold on, elephant. Anyway, it's already the case that tvOS does not get a whole lot of mentions on a WWDC that is mm-hmm. not super packed. So I am curious, have there been any rumors about tvOS updates that are worth talking about, or kind of have all of those rolled out already? I know your colleague and Six Colors pal wrote about the new picture-in-picture mode in sports. So is that what we're going to see from tvOS, or is there a possibility?
Yeah, all indications seem to be it's going to be a pretty quiet year for tvOS. There doesn't seem to be anything really floating around out there, which is not to say that Apple couldn't pull something out of its hat, but I certainly wouldn't expect it to be sort of a major overhaul or anything of that kind. If anything, they might even just tout stuff that they've already done, like adding this multi-cam sort of approach, and perhaps maybe some deals with some partners or something like that. But I really don't expect it. I think there's a good chance tvOS may not even make it into the keynote proper. It may sort of just get a little note on the website afterwards. Oh yeah, there's a few things we're adding to tvOS too.
Yeah, I think tvOS and those who pay attention to it are used to that. I remember last year sort of going to the website. Now, what about macOS Petaluma, which is certainly going to be the next version of macOS? What have we heard?
Oh, you've got information I don't have then,
Micah. What do we know about the next version?
Yeah, not much. Also, macOS seems to be pretty quiet as well. Anything that's coming there might be linked to a hardware announcement. I'm sure there will be some small features too. I think one thing to look for this year, and I think this has been the case in recent years as well, is this idea of Apple sort of rolling out new features that go across its entire lineup of products. So you may see more and more stuff that's announced like, hey, we're doing this and it works on all of our devices, the iPad, the iPhone, the Mac, etc. Look for something more like that, because I think it saves them a little bit time, and it gets out of this weird structure they had where they'd announce something for the iPhone and they wouldn't say anything about the Mac, and then like 20 minutes later when they're talking about the Mac, it's like, oh yeah, it also does that thing the iPhone does. So I would look more for things like that, where it's going to be like, these are improvements we're making across the board, and they'll apply to the Mac as well as everything else. And then of course, yeah, what's the name? macOS Petaluma, macOS Sonoma, macOS Big Bear? I don't know. Something California related.
So, yes, we know it will be California related, but it we'll see. Now, there is a little bit of news, and you actually wrote about this, that WatchOS may be something to watch. Tell us about what we can expect from WatchOS.
Sure. Yeah. So the Apple Watch is coming up on the 9th anniversary of its announcement, not its release, but fall will be the 9th anniversary. And it seems to be the indications are we'll see a big overhaul in WatchOS 10. And that may take the form of a new widget-based system that allows developers to sort of create these little screens of information where you can get easy little bits of data without having to open an app itself. Think about stuff like we've seen on iOS in recent years, or as well on the iPad, on the home screen and on the lock screen, various places. This whole sort of widget kit framework that Apple's developed is very extensible. And I think there's a good chance that we'll see something up in the watch, because it's the perfect place for sort of, hey, I just want to check the weather. Early on, way back when Apple first announced the Apple Watch, it had this feature called Glances, which was this idea of an app that was just like a single screen. And I think they're trying another shot at that in a different sort of technological way, but with the same idea of this is what you really want is glanceable information. You don't want to spend 5 minutes interacting with an app on your watch. You're just there to find something and then go back to whatever you were doing. So we may see some changes to how things like digital crown or the side button on the Apple Watch work. Apple may sort of mix up like what those features do. But I look for something that's sort of a bigger overhaul. This seems to be where a lot of the software attention has gone this year.
Got it. And then let's go ahead and bring in the elephant. As much as every year I talk about how software is the main focus of WWDC, it is not always the case. And this year we've heard rumor on rumor on rumor about new hardware launching at WWDC. But I'm not ready to grab the big elephant. I'm going to grab the little pink one, which is the one that if
I'm floating around in your vision.
Exactly. I need to talk to somebody about that. But it, I can see written on the side, I guess it's tattooed on the side, it says Mac hardware. So can we expect Mac hardware at this event, or should we maybe expect it?
You know, it's interesting. If you'd asked me a few weeks ago, I would have bet on no. There have been rumors floating around out there about a 15-inch MacBook Air, which is basically just a larger version of the 13-inch Air that Apple already sells, and that's it's its most popular computer. So it makes sense that they want to expand into a larger screen as well. I didn't think necessarily it would get time in the keynote because it seems like a keynote that's got a lot going on, but it seems that it may be one of possibly several new Macs. A recent report from Mark Gurman over at Bloomberg suggests that Apple is looking at rolling out several new Macs on stage on Monday. What those are, that's a big question, because a lot of the apps, a lot of the Macs have been recently revamped, and it doesn't seem like Apple's necessarily in a position to roll out brand new hardware. But rumors seem to be coalescing around things, possibly a new Mac Studio, and then possibly, I think maybe a 13-inch MacBook Pro as well was mentioned. And then there's the Mac Pro that's been floating out there for a while. Apple famously said it was going to finish its Apple Silicon transition in 2 years. That was back in 2020. Let me just check the calendar with the glanceable information on my Apple Watch. It is 2023. We did not finish. But they teased it last spring in 2022 during the Mac Studios announcement. So where is the Mac Pro? Will it get shown off? Will it get mentioned? Will they just never talk about it again? We don't know, but it could happen next week.
Oh boy, it's all fading, or they're hoping it'll fade into the background. Maybe, we'll see. And then now it's time. There's been so much talk about Apple, at the very least, revealing and talking about its mixed reality headset. Of course, I'd love to hear what you know we might know, but I'm also curious to hear if you think this is going to be a product that is fully announced at WWDC, or if this is just going to be a matter of it being teased at the event.
Yeah, I think this is a good question. At this point, there's been so much smoke that if there's not a fire, I don't know what the fire department's here. But yeah, I think that the Apple headset is definitely coming. It's going to be showed off. My guess is it's something that's going to be given a lot of time, both on stage and potentially in sort of ancillary events around this, because what this event, you know, as you said, Micah, early on, this is here for developers. This is here for people who are writing software for Apple's platform. And when Apple is rolling out a brand new platform and it wants to get developers on board, it needs to find a way to bring them in. And that's potentially going to mean not only being able to show off what this product is, but also explain from a brand new software platform standpoint, like, here are the tools that you can use to build apps for this. Here's how we're going to help you get your existing apps over there. Here are the opportunities for you to build new apps. All of that means it's a big play for Apple. And so I think that it's going to get more than just sort of a brief, vague tease. Now, we may not get all the details. Mm-hmm. It's possible we won't get a ship date. That seems likely, in fact, given the word that it's going to take a little longer than expected. It's possible we won't even get a price, which is obviously also something that's been talked about a lot. So we may not get all the details, but I'm guessing from a technological standpoint, Apple's going to want to paint a pretty complete picture here of the device that it's making and what the value proposition is for users and developers alike.
Understood. Now, is there anything else that we've heard rumored that we might expect at WWDC outside of what we've talked about thus far, not necessarily hardware, but any features that have kind of stuck out to you or any other hardware that could get announced?
Yeah, it's not a lot. I think there's a couple interesting things to look for. In particular, there's been this ongoing rumor of Apple having to open up its platform, especially iOS, to apps sideloaded because incoming legislation potentially from the European Union may affect that in some way. So I think we're going to have to look at that and sort of see, like, maybe they don't come out and say it because they obviously don't want to give it a lot of attention if they don't have to, but maybe look for clues or breadcrumbs in some of the announcements they do make to say, like, oh, you know, that makes sense that they put that in there if they're preparing for a future where they might have to start sideloading apps or allowing users to sideload apps. So I think that's one thing in particular that I've got my eyes on, is just sort of keeping an ear cocked and seeing if there's something that they talk about in the presentation that you might wonder, why are they talking about this? And then sort of in a larger context, oh yeah, this is laying groundwork for something that's coming later. Because it's something Apple likes to do a lot, is to like introduce new technologies that may not be immediately something that people use, but may sort of set the stage for something that's coming in a few years.
Got it. Yeah, that that'll be interesting to see, especially given the slight changes we've seen thus far and all of the little software features that have been added. And sometimes you don't find out until later by looking through what different little events that are taking place.
The small fine print is always important.
Yes, exactly. Well, Dan Morin, I want to thank you so much for taking some time out of your day to join us. Safe travels as you join us here in California soon. And I will see you on Monday. But until then, if folks want to follow you online and check out the work you're doing, where should they go to do so?
You can check out all my writing about Apple at sixcolors.com, and I write a weekly column over at Macworld called Stay Foolish. As well, I host the tech show The Rebound, which you can find at reboundcast.com. And Mike and I co-host Clockwise over at relay.fm. I'm also a science fiction author. You can find all my books and information about that at dmorin.com.
Beautiful. Thank you, Dan.
Thanks, Mike. I look forward to seeing you Monday.
See you then. Bye-bye. Alrighty, up next we've got Jason's story of the week. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Bitwarden. Bitwarden is the only open source cross-platform password manager that you can use at home, at work, on the go, and it's trusted by millions. Even our very own Steve Gibson of Security Now has switched over. With Bitwarden, all of the data in your vault is end-to-end encrypted. Not just those passwords. You can protect your data and privacy with Bitwarden by adding security to your passwords with strong, randomly generated passwords for each account. And then take that even one step further with the username generator. This lets you create unique usernames for each account. And you can also use any of the 5 integrated email alias services. I'll talk more about that in a moment. Bitwarden is open source as well, with all the code available on GitHub for anyone to view. So that means you don't have to trust Bitwarden's word for it. You can see that it's completely secure. Checking on that code. On top of being public for the world, Bitwarden also has professional third-party audits performed every year, and the results are also published on their website. This is open source security you can trust. Bitwarden also launched a new Bitwarden Secrets Manager, currently in beta. It's an end-to-end encrypted solution that allows teams of developers to centrally secure, manage, and deploy sensitive secrets like API keys and machine credentials. Secrets Manager keeps those sensitive developer secrets out of source code and eliminates the risk of them being exposed to the public. Bitwarden needs developers to help test out the new Secrets Manager and provide feedback. So if that sparked your interest, well, you can learn more at bitwarden.com/secrets-beta. Share private data securely with coworkers across departments or the entire company with fully customizable and adaptive plans. Bitwarden's Teams organization option is $3 a month per user, while their enterprise organization plan is just $5 a month per user. And of course, individuals can always use the basic free account for an unlimited number of passwords. Upgrade anytime to a premium account for less than $1 a month, or you can bring the whole family with their family organization option to give up to 6 users premium features for only $3.33 a month. Man, those prices are amazing. I mentioned I was going to talk about that email alias service. What's great about this is you can basically, when you go and you create a new account, you can generate a new password, obviously, a pseudorandom password, but then you can also generate a custom username for that account. And then to take things even further, to make things even more secure, you can integrate with something like Fastmail, who's another sponsor on the network, and have it generate a unique email so that all of those are only tied to that account. That means that if that account were ever, that service was ever breached and that information was taken, that's the only place where it exists. It's not going to mean that the bad actor is going to have access to any of your other information if those are the three things that you're using there. It's really smart. So consider signing up for Bitwarden at Twit. We are fans of password managers. I know all of us encourage the use of password managers for family, friends, and listeners. Bitwarden is the only open source cross-platform password manager that can be used at home, on the go, or at work, and is trusted by millions of individuals, teams, and organizations worldwide. Get started with a free trial of a Teams or Enterprise plan, or get started for free across all devices as an individual user at bitwarden.com/twit. That's bitwarden.com/twit. Thank you, Bitwarden, for sponsoring this week's episode of Tech News Weekly. All righty, Jason Howell, it's time for your story.
All right. So this is interesting. So we all remember, maybe we don't, but I remember when Twitter not too long ago changed its API policy.
Yep.
And it kind of it impacted, you know, third party apps pretty significantly. Mm-hmm. Reddit has an IPO on the horizon somewhere this year. It's expected that Reddit's going to file for its IPO. And so leading up to this, it seems like they're making some changes, some house cleaning, right? We heard, if we go back in time since 2008, the API and their policy on the API has been very loose. Mm-hmm. It's been very open, for access. So that means that developers could build many things to interoperate and to interact with, the Reddit service. So you got, you know, third party Reddit apps, of which I've used many. I now use the official app, which maybe makes me an outlier. I know a lot of people hate the official app,
but you've been pulled into it. We'll talk about that in a moment, but I have somewhat. Yeah.
Yeah. So yes, it's absolutely. We can talk about that. Developers creating third-party tools for things like moderation. It's encouraged a lot of, you know, this stuff, these different services and apps that make Reddit better in many ways, or make it kind of wider, you know, a wider appeal for people that don't like the traditional Reddit approach. Making ways to aid in search across that massive data set, right?
Huge.
Being able to search that and use that in many different ways. Recently, though, it became the source for something much more data hungry. And that is, you know, we're always talking about AI and we're talking about these data sets and how those data sets are trained around human communication and everything. And Reddit is a ripe source for the picking when it comes to that. So you've got this massive data set of people communicating with each other. A ton of information and knowledge, and Reddit's open API policy, meaning open access. So people building businesses around AI can very freely go and pull all that information down and feed it into their system. And suddenly their system that they make their own, you know, profit off of is kind of riding on the coattails of the information that Reddit generates. And as we all know, data is valuable, right? Mm-hmm. So Reddit announced back in April that it would be updating its terms for developers for embeds, ads, and data APIs. Instead of free access to all this data, it would now come at a cost. And CEO Steve Huffman told the New York Times, "We don't need to give all of that value to some of the largest companies in the world for free." So that tells you where they're coming from. They suddenly, you know, realize after decades of offering this stuff for free, wait a minute, this is really valuable. And, you know, a lot of people are guessing with the IPO kind of around the corner, it makes more sense for them to button these things up so that they have even more ways of satisfying shareholders once we get there, right? So it's understandable. Reddit did say that the API would stay free for certain use cases, things like moderation tools, things like educational and research applications. So that's good. Not, you know, not a cost associated with entirely everything. But one big question then was how it would impact the community of third-party apps, which has, as of, you know, up till now been very vibrant. Mm-hmm. Like there are, you know, many developers have created a business out of their third-party apps to access Reddit and kind of filled the holes. Of course, Reddit does a lot of things within their apps that these third-party apps probably, I'm guessing at this point, because I haven't used them in a while, don't do, you know, ads, serving ads. Yep. Reddit's able to easily control that experience through their app. But are third-party developers able to do an app for browsing Reddit that doesn't include the ads, those revenue-generating things? Probably so. Reddit had mentioned at the time that it planned on enforcing limits on how many API requests could be made by a single app or service. And then, you know, of course, some sort of a fee associated with that information. And when we're talking about independent developers who have built these apps, largely independent developers, even a small amount of money to access that data could have, I mean, crippling impact yeah. to their business.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where we're at. So that's all the setup. Kristen Selig is the developer of the popular client Apollo, posted in the Apollo app subreddit. Of course, the creator of a Reddit app has a subreddit for the app that people are using to update fans of the app on what the future holds. And his example shows that it's not good for third-party app developers. And I think people were hoping that Reddit would still be friendly. And there was kind of like this hope trail that Reddit had been laying out. Like, no, it's okay. We'll work with you, work with you. Well, Christian started this post with, I'll cut to the chase. 50 million requests cost $12,000, a figure far more than I could ever have imagined. Apollo made 7 billion requests last month, which would put it at about $1.7 million per month, $20 million US dollars per year, to run a third-party Reddit browsing app.
Yeah, which is that you're not even bringing in that amount of money.
No, and I think there that he does have a subscription-based aspect to the business.
Yeah.
But I mean, these apps largely, as they have been for decades at this point, are bought once, you know, I'm going to buy the Apollo app and you know, so there's no, unless you're doing some sort of a subscription service, there is no recurring generated
right.
revenue along
you
the way.
You buy it and you've got it. Yeah.
So the idea of coming up with 20 million US dollars per year to support the flow of data requests that the app is making. And that's just to pay Reddit.
Yeah.
That's not anything to do with the other costs of running the business.
Development costs and some costs for him.
And yeah. for him, mm-hmm. primarily, like he has to make a living. You know, his staff, if he has staff, you know, a lot of independent developers, they do it entirely themselves, but they have to make a living. Otherwise, like, you know, maybe they enjoy it. I don't know, yeah. but I'm sure they do enjoy it, but I'm sure they also want to make a living
right.
off
that's
of it.
That's why you can do that and maybe focus on that alone.
Yeah.
And not have to worry about other things. And when you were talking about this, it brought me back to every time, because I'm not really a Reddit person, although I do, when I do browse Reddit, I use Apollo.
Okay.
And have spoken with Kristen before. And like incredible developer and super sharp about the process and everything. Mm. But something that's always been the case that I've seen is anytime I click on a Reddit link, it always is trying to get me to view it in the Reddit app.
In the app,
it's yeah. always trying to push me to this, push me to that. It's felt like for a long time they've been doing what Twitter started to do, where features weren't available in third-party apps that you could get in the first-party app mm-hmm. to bring people into it. I ended up giving up and just switching to Twitter, the actual app, many years ago now.
I did that too.
Yeah. I was a third-party developer or third-party app user for a long time, and then yeah, I switched over. And so I'm not surprised to hear you say that you switched over to the official Reddit app, because I'm sure it's the same kind of thing. You just kind of end up giving up on a third-party app being able to provide the full experience, mm-hmm. and it slowly snuffs it out. In this case, the developer has landed on something that is enough magic that it's keeping a lot of people around. And then it's so sad to see this possibility of that spark getting snuffed.
Poof.
And yep. for the sake of a company going public, I didn't even know that Reddit made money in the first place, to be honest with you. I was like, how does it even make money? Ads obviously make
yeah,
sense.
Yeah.
But I don't know if I've ever really seen too many of them or, but again, I'm not on Reddit very often. So yeah,
yeah,
that it was all, it was a surprise to me to learn that they were going to IPO. Cause I thought, I didn't know that there was a way for this company to make any money, just thought it sort of existed.
Yeah. Right.
And so I think that's, that is for it to IPO and make most of its money through ads and it doesn't
and now the value of its data.
Yeah. I guess I don't foresee in my mind enough developers being able to afford to offer third party apps. No. So then I don't see Reddit really making a whole lot of money off of the API access. So it's really got to do it from the ad side of things mm-hmm. because the places that are going to stick around are going to be the ones that can offer it for that, that Reddit offers for free to education, to research, da, da, da. So yeah. Does that mean that people are going to see double the ads, you know, whenever they go public? And then does that mean that Reddit's slowly going to, you know, become less popular because mm-hmm. there's less content that you actually, it's just, it's all capitalism. It's a mess.
I mean, that's exactly it, right? It's at the end of the day, it's capitalism. It's a business that, and I hate to say this, but it's all, I think it like, 99 out of 100 times, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. At a certain point, a business just it kind of does that crossover where it's like, well, you know what? The money's really damn important. Mm-hmm. And we have to do this. We have to do this for any number of reasons. And at the root of that is driven by capitalism. And that's just the, you know, that's
where it
that's,
always goes. Yeah.
That's the realm that I guess we live with here in the US and business and all that. You know, and I also hate to say this, but it's true, is that anytime you build a business on the back of another business, you know,
you
see the comment that I made 30 seconds ago. It's not a matter of if, but when.
Yeah.
And so if you build a business that ties in, that is a third party client of something else, they're allowing it now. There's probably a time where they're not going to allow it. And if you haven't considered that as a possibility, then you're kind of living in a fantasy land, because I think it does happen eventually. And when that happens, you know, I mean, it's unfortunate because these are developers who have poured their heart and their soul into apps. They've made a living for, you know, a decade or however long they've been doing this. And they have a lot of people that support them in that. They've got this great community, all these wonderful things. But at the end of the day, it's Reddit's business and Reddit can choose what it wants to do. And, you know, it's choosing this. And I think I'm curious to know how deeply Reddit looked into the impact of this, because it seemed like they were painting a picture that like, no, you know what, we're going to work with you. But this is like, you know, as Christian said, this is not anywhere rooted in reality as far as third party developers of these apps are concerned. None of them are going to be able to afford $20 million a year.
Yeah.
So then was that just all, you know, all words and that was it?
It's like that bird that eats the fish out of a crocodile's mouth. You know, it's sort of a beneficial relationship.
Yeah.
But then I guess the crocodile gets dental health insurance and doesn't need the bird anymore. And so the bird just has to find food elsewhere.
Yeah.
But it can't. So then it languishes. And all of these little third-party apps are those Egyptian plover birds that that are just flitting away because they can't eat. Crocodile's got a dentist now, so
yeah,
that's too bad.
I mean, I do feel that, you know, someone with Christian's pedigree, mm-hmm. like, you know, there are a lot of subpar okay developers out there. Christian is obviously a great developer,
made like one of the most, at least on iOS's side, probably arguably the most popular third party Reddit client,
right?
And so that is there are many voices there, you know what I mean? That's a big group, so
yeah.
That's
a pedigree that he can do something with, but you know, it's got to be hard when you've built up this thing. And now you're faced with, well, that thing's going away and I wish it wasn't, but it is. So what the heck now?
Ugh.
So
it's a shame.
Yeah, it is. So what do you have here? I you know, this actually was breaking news this morning, but Meta has a new Quest coming out. And I'm curious to know if you're going to be grabbing one of these and throwing it on your face.
So what's fascinating here, or I guess it's not fascinating, what's predictable here is that, of course, on Monday, Apple is rumored to be announcing its mixed reality headset.
And the timing of it all.
So Meta, which, of course, is the Facebook parent company, pulled out an Instagram video of all things. Zuckerberg posted on Instagram. And then shortly after that, Instagram post went out with a video and a little write-up. Then Facebook's blog, or excuse me, I guess Meta's blog, but it is still at about.fb.com. So
yeah,
put out the sort of understanding of what this next headset is. And they're really pushing the mixed reality aspect of this headset. They call it meta reality. And it's something that is available in the Quest 2 that's available right now. And in, of course, the Quest Pro that's available. In the Quest 2, you have these lower quality cameras that can show you black and white view of what's in front of you. And for a long time, it was not super involved. You would tap twice on the side of the headset and then it would cut to that view, and you could walk around, while keeping the headset on and see things that were around you, but it wasn't very high detail. It wasn't, sort of a one-to-one, if you can think of it that way, view of what you were seeing. And so one way that I had hoped to use that was if there was a service I was trying to log into on the Quest 2, what I had to do was take off the headset, get the next six digits of the password, put the headset back on, type them in, take off the headset again, memorize the next six, do over and over, because with that black and white view, bright screens and frankly, displays in general did not show the text very well at all. So I couldn't keep the headset on. It was messy. It was not good. And just in general, to try to call that mixed reality is not realistic. Now, the Pro came along and I did get to try that out. We, was that Ask the Tech Guys at the time?
I think it was.
Yeah. What was that? Was it? It was, oh yeah, it was the Tech Guys. Yeah. So it was right before we made the change to the new show. So it was still the radio show.
Got it.
And we did, I did a sort of demo of the system, and its mixed reality was better for sure. And now they're trying to improve that even more. They have what's called high fidelity color pass through. So this is going to give you that actual color view of what's in front of you. They're also touting a new Snapdragon processor that has two times the GPU power of the Quest 2. They're talking about how it's slimmer in design, quote, 40% slimmer optic profile. I'm assuming that means that the sort of portion that goes out in front of your face, the optic profile is slimmer.
Flatter,
yeah. So like a little closer to your face.
Doesn't project out as much.
Exactly. So okay, it's maybe not going to weigh you down as much.
Yeah. That's welcome.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. The touch controllers have been updated as well. They now don't have that ring around the top of them. So that face or Meta says that that's because they got the feedback that that could kind of make people feel a little like they were a little trapped inside of it. So when they were moving their hand, they would hit the ring. So they wanted to make it feel a little bit more free. So they updated that. Yeah, I didn't have that issue either. And they're going to continue selling the Quest 2 and Quest Pro alongside the Quest 3. So all of the models will be available. What else is kind of interesting is that they've announced that on June 4th, they will once again lower the Quest 2's price to $299.99. So $300 USD for the 128 gigabyte model of the Quest 2.
And that's the day before WWDC?
That's the day before. Yeah, it is, isn't it? So it is, I'm happy that they're doing that because I thought it was really annoyed by the fact that they had raised the price.
Yeah, me too.
For the same, they didn't improve it. It was the same device. They just raised the price on it.
That
does not compute. No. I was really bothered by that. But now they're bringing it back down. And while they're bringing it back down, there's also going to be a software update that somehow is going to improve GPU and CPU performance on both the Quest 2 and the Quest Pro. So the headsets we already have will also be seeing an improvement to CPU and GPU performance. You know, you get somebody in there who knows how to properly tax the CPU and GPU and do it in a better way, and that can make those little performance improvements. So this is kind of a full featured or a full set of announcements from Meta, not just for the Quest 3, but for the whole suite of offerings that the company has. When they talk about Meta Reality, they are really, it's interesting to see how much of the focus is on that. Because with the Quest Pro, the thing that I didn't like about the Quest Pro is that the bottom of the Quest Pro is open to your eyes. And they had these little magnetic things that you could clip into them. They're like silicone and they're magnetic. Mm-hmm. And it would sort of guard the bottom of your eyes, but still light was getting through. And I felt that that kind of pulled me out of the experience. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was an odd choice for the Quest 2. It feels like what they're trying to do with this Quest 3 is keep you fully immersed in VR, but then also provide the opportunity for augmented reality by creating that full color pass through. So they have a little game that they show in the, well, I don't even know if it's a game per se. It looks like a game, but it could just be a concept of what looks a lot like a Dungeons and Dragons game. And so the person has the headset on, and then on their table in augmented reality is a full kind of game board with little characters, and they've got a roll of the dice that they can do as they are. Yeah, here we can perhaps show that part of it. We just switched back. So anyway, it will be interesting to see how the Quest 3 compares to the Quest Pro, meaning I'm curious how the lineup is going to fit into what's already there, or rather how the new model is going to fit into the lineup that already exists, right? Because if we've got the Quest 2, which is kind of the every person's Quest, that is the most accessible, most cost.
Yeah, $300 basically.
Yeah, and then you've got the Quest 3, which is all of this next generation stuff. It's got new handsets, blah, 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 blah. Where does the Quest Pro fit in? What Meta suggests is that the Quest Pro is meant for work, that it is a model that people will use when they are trying to get work done. And so you, I guess you have...
which not many people are using a VR headset for work right now. It's just not.
Yeah, they're like, well, it's got the eye tracking and this and that and the other. So you're going to be able to, look like you're the real person in meetings. And I don't know. I don't think so.
I think it's a stretch.
Yeah. But
yeah,
the last thing I'll say about it is that they are really touting, and I think this is where they actually do have a point, the huge library of games and content that exists
for sure
for the Quest.
That's I think a big strength for Oculus for the Quest devices right now, is that library is pretty solid and easy to get lost in if you're in the store. You know what I mean? There's so many titles coming on this. They had a kind of a games announcement, and I don't know if you've ever power washed in real life, but it's really satisfying. Oh my gosh,
I love power washing.
And and there's Power Wash Simulator is a game that's coming.
I didn't know it hasn't come out yet, but it will be.
It's coming to MetaQuest, I think, for the first time. Like you can get it in other.
That I'll actually VR. Play. I haven't picked up my VR headset in so long.
Yeah.
My Quest, I probably need to charge it so the batteries don't start losing their juice.
Yeah. My daughter has asked a couple of times in the last couple of weeks to play VR, and it had been, you know, very, very distant since the time before. So she's starting to kind of pick up on it again. And I find myself, because we've got the first one and we've got the second one. Mm-hmm. And the first one, of course, at this point is totally outdated, right, and kind of slow, and they don't even really support it and everything. But I love playing VR with her. But the last two times she's asked, I've not felt like I would feel very good if I did. And yeah, so I wanted to pass on it, which I think is just such a huge hurdle for anything VR. It's like, you got to be feeling great to throw that on your face. And that's, yeah, it's just not always the case. But I am really interested or curious, like the question that you posed, that basically it's three price tiers. It's $300 for the Quest 2, $500 for the Quest 3, and then $1,000 for the Quest Pro. And I don't believe the whole get work done thing with a pro. Like, I think that's a pipe dream.
And I've used the Quest Pro, and I will say the tracking on it is quite impressive. So after the day that I did the demo here in the studio, Leo let me take it home for a couple of days. Maybe it was like a week. And I played, I think the game's called I Expect You to Die.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And in my space, without having to rearrange a bunch of stuff, it was able to put the little traps all over the room. And as I was moving through the space, you know, it wasn't as if they were going and sort of changing locations. I was impressed by that. I didn't get ill playing that game because the tracking was good enough. But still, when I thought, oh, because it's so good, because the refresh rate is higher, because the optics are better, let me try playing a game that before would make me sick, which is any game where you have to, where the movement is not just you moving around, but instead you like use a controller to move in the virtual space.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That,
I can't play any of those.
Yeah, that's hard.
And so I tried, and I was able to play for maybe 10 minutes, which is more than I was able to do in the Quest 2. But after that, I thought, I'm done. Like, I can't do this again for a week. So no, it's just not worth it. So that $1,000 price point is...
Well, and especially because the Quest 3 has better resolution, like better optics, my understanding, than the Quest Pro. So then you got to really ask yourself, like, what are you getting from a hardware perspective from the Quest Pro? Anyways, it's kind of confusing. It really does feel like, you know, Apple is going to probably do what Apple does, suck the oxygen out of the room. So they had to get this out. I mean, the timing is like so timed with what Apple is expected to do on Monday. They got to kind of get that announcement out there before every article that's written about their new hardware is also added to it with, you know, Meta's trying hard to captivate the audience they already have because Apple's on their heels and we know what Apple does. And that whole narrative, you know, is going to happen. And so
I think keeping in mind, Apple has built out its Apple Arcade service. It's almost certainly been working with game developers in Apple Arcade and elsewhere. So it will be quick, I think, for the company to roll into having a pretty good library of content, which is, I think, what Meta currently has as the sort of that's where it leads right now. So to see that shift, also, Gurman has said on the show and in his blog posts or newsletters that a lot of the iPad apps are just going to run by default on the headset. They obviously aren't going to have, they're not going to be, you know, VR experiences, but even having, you know, that's the thing about the Quest 2 or the Quest. If I put that on and I wanted to then use Slack and, you know, have three different screens open, for example, I mentioned earlier having to like take the headset off, log, do all this stuff. I have to have it set up to where my computer can talk to it over the, like, there's so much involved with doing that in any of the, but yet they call it this, you know, you can work and da da da. Apple could quickly have FaceTime working. So now you've got communication back and forth. They launched before this their scheduled FaceTime system where you could have different people. And we thought that was kind of competing with Zoom at the time. But now thinking about it this way, where suddenly work and play are all right there in that one headset and you're like switching back and forth between the two. It's, I, they're, They've got Meta's going to have to really, I think, step it up. Mm-hmm. If this headset sort of optically lives up to what we have heard about it, because I think that's the big thing.
Yep.
But Meta's also more accessible. Because we were just complaining about $1,000
for a headset. Far less expensive. Yes, and I know. We've heard
$3,000 for the first version of Apple's.
So. I mean, and maybe that's the Quest Pro. That's why it exists, or that's why they lean into work. Because if Apple's leaning into work, which I mean, I think that's a large part of what we expect their communication to be about it, and it's a three times more expensive device. Then Meta can say, well, we do that too. And you pay a third of what you pay for Apple. And it does all these things. And we've got our great library of, you know, all the games and other stuff along with it. So maybe the Meta Quest Pro doesn't make sense in the lineup yet because that comparison doesn't exist yet. But once it does, then it's like, okay.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's still a long way to go to try and prove its reason for existing by comparison. I think most people don't buy the Pro. I think that's just the way it is right now. So interesting. Plus,
and the last, of course, Microsoft also has its fingers in the workspace Pi. HoloLens has been pivoted into industry and work. And then we've seen Magic Leap also start to think about doing industry and work.
Yep.
So a lot of these companies are focusing on sort of work aspect. But what I think that Apple pushing it for work is going to be more from the individual level.
Mm-hmm.
So you as an individual can work and play, as opposed to where these other companies are going, hey, companies, buy these headsets and let your workers use them at work. It's more on the, I feel, the Apple side. It's not, hey, companies, buy these.
It's more like personal productivity in a work environment.
Exactly.
Like, instead of sitting at my desk in my office and looking at a flat screen on the wall, I can have many screens that surround me and do so much more in my day to day.
And I would love to have that, but not if I feel trapped inside.
Totally. I totally agree. So. That would be neat. But if it comes at the expense of having to wear something hot and warm on my, you know, get hot, that hot face feeling
and then get
slightly, slightly woozy and everything. Like, this is not worth it.
You're looking around and things feel a little off. It's like after you go on a roller coaster or go to an amusement park all day and you've been on roller coasters and then you lay down at night.
Yeah.
And the whole
room feel like you're still on the roller coaster.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
You feel, that's the nightmare. You lay down and you feel like you're still in the office.
Oh, no! I can never escape work.
This is horrible. All right. So we've now shot that idea out of the water entirely.
Bye-bye.
There we go. That's the future. Well, we've reached the end of this episode of Tech News Weekly. We thank you each and every week for joining us. Twit.tv/TNW is the place for you to go, not just to watch what we have, but to subscribe. That's the most important thing for what we do here as a podcast network. We appreciate when you subscribe. That makes sure you get each and every episode that we produce. And it helps us out too, because we get some, we get details about how many people are getting our episodes, and that's valuable for keeping the lights on. So thank you, twit.tv/TNW.
Yes. And please consider joining the club at twit.tv/clubtwit. That's another way that you can help us keep making these shows that we love to bring to you. Starting at $7 a month, $84 a year, you can join the club, twit.tv/clubtwit. When you do, you get a bunch of great stuff. First, ad-free episodes of every single show on the Twit Network. You also get access to the Twit Plus bonus feed that has extra content you won't find anywhere else. Behind the scenes, before the show, after the show, special Club Twit events all get published there. It's a great stream that, you know, you could subscribe to now and go back and look at a bunch of cool stuff that's already been published there. You also can join the Club Twit Discord, a fun place to go to chat with your fellow Club Twit members and also those of us here at Twit. I'm sure you've heard someone somewhere talking about chatting in the Discord. There are loads of Discords out there. We've got one too. It's a fun place to hang out. Again, all available starting at $7 a month, $84 a year, twit.tv/clubtwit. Now, we heard from some folks who said, look, $7, fine, but you keep adding more great stuff to the club and I would like to give you some more money. So that's why I say starting at, because you have the option if you'd like to $8, $9, $10 a month, whatever you feel you'd like to give starting at $7 is what you can choose to give. Along with all of that stuff I just mentioned, you get some Club Twit exclusive shows. These are shows that are only available as a subscribing member. There's Hands on Windows, which is a show from Paul Thurrott that covers Windows tips and tricks. There's the Untitled Linux Show, which is a show all about Linux for all of you Linux fans out there. There's my show, Hands on Mac, which is all about Apple tips and tricks in short little tidbits and bites. So you can check out that back catalog and see, oh, I didn't know. I want to learn more about this. I'd like to check this out. Right now I'm going through window management on the Mac, and this has been a lot of fun to cover. And also, yes, we keep adding more Club Twit exclusive shows. And as more members join the club, that means the more shows we can think about bringing to you in the club. You should check out Home Theater Geeks, which is now relaunched in the club, featuring the inimitable Scott Wilkinson, covering all sorts of topics related to home theater. Please sign up, tell your friends, tell your family, anybody who you think would be interested in some great podcasts and some great ad-free episodes of Twit and everything in between, twit.tv/clubtwit. If you'd like to follow me online, I'm at Micah Sargent, or you can head to chihuahua.coffee. Just recently updated that. So now it's got my most recent places that I exist online, my podcasts, all that kind of stuff. So chihuahua.coffee, where I've got links to the places I'm most active online. And please check out my shows later today if you're a Club Twit member. That's when Hands on Mac publishes. On Sundays, I record Ask the Tech Guys with Leo Laporte, where we take your questions and answer them. 888-724-2884 is the number you call for that. And on Tuesdays, I record iOS Today with Rosemary Orchard. Plus, this coming week, you can also catch me on Mac Break Weekly, where I will be talking about my experience from WWDC. Wow, that was kind of hard to say that time, from the day before on that Monday. So please consider tuning in to check out all that great stuff. Jason Howell, where can folks find you?
That really is great stuff. I'm looking forward to hearing what your experience at WWDC is.
Thanks.
At Jason Howell on Twitter, twit.social/@Jason Howell on Mastodon. Here doing shows like All About Android every Tuesday, twit.tv/AAA. Subscribe and get lots of awesome stuff about the Android operating system. And so much more behind the scenes, doing a lot of stuff behind the scenes. So that's where you can find me. I do want to thank John Ashley, John Slanina, Burke McQuinn, everyone here at the studio who helps us each and every week to do this show. We couldn't do it without y'all. And we couldn't do it without you at home or on the subway or in the car, wherever you happen to be watching and listening to Tech News Weekly each and every week. Thank you so much for doing that. And we will see you all next Thursday on Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye. Last week, I just did this for myself.
Nice. I like that. Oh, that's a good one. That's the solo.
Hey, we should talk Linux. It's the operating system that runs the internet, but your game consoles, cell phones, and maybe even the machine on your desk. But you already knew all that. What you may not know is that Twit now has a show dedicated to it, the Untitled Linux Show. Whether you're a Linux pro, a burgeoning sysadmin, or just curious what the big deal is, you should join us on the Club Twit Discord every Saturday afternoon for news, analysis, and tips to sharpen your Linux skills. And then make sure you subscribe to the Club Twit exclusive Untitled Linux Show. Wait, you're not a Club Twit member yet? Well, go to twit.tv/clubtwit and sign up. Hope to see you there.